Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the plans of Elizabeth Warren, and Richard, people who have been paying attention to the race for the Democratic presidential nomination know that Elizabeth Warren's calling card has become this phrase, "I've got a plan for that." This prefaces virtually every one of her policy proposals, and this has led to her getting a lot of credit in some precincts as a policy wonk, and some people are saying this is a big factor in why she's been doing so well in the polls of late. So what I thought we'd do today is to subject some of those plans to your critical eye, and we'll start with the topic that was the subject of your Defining Ideas column this week, which is Warren essentially calling the business roundtable to live up to its rhetoric on its recent statement about corporations having the obligation to all of their stakeholders as opposed to just shareholders. This is something we did a show on a couple of months ago. But why don't you start out by reminding us what the business roundtable was getting at there, and then walk us through what Elizabeth Warren would like to see corporate America do as a result.
Yes. We actually had a nice discussion on this at the Classical Liberal Institute the other day. So I got a sense of it both from one of the lawyers who worked at Wachtell, who was active in helping Jamie Dimon put this plan together, and one of its defenders from the business community. And the best way to start this is to take two words which sound innocent and then to see what their potential ramifications are. The traditional model talked about shareholders as being the only stakeholders to whom a corporate officer or director owed a fiduciary duty of care and loyalty. But if you look at the Jamie Dimon statement, he uses a lot of business school jargon to the effect that we are committed to stakeholders, and the two words that you have to put sense to are stakeholder and commitment. And both of them are fraught to some extent with ambiguity. One of the things you could say is a stakeholder is somebody who has a stake in the business, which means he's a part owner. But they're not using it in that particular way. What they're talking about as stakeholder is any constituency which has some concern with the success or failure of a particular corporation. They mention four of these. See if I could get them. They mention the employees. They mention the suppliers. They mention the customers. And they mention the communities. Interestingly enough, the one set of stakeholders who closest to shareholders are the bondholders. But evidently, for these purposes, they don't count. And then the question is, what does it mean to be committed to? Within the traditional logic of shareholder supremacy, being committed to was very simply this. In order to be able to make money for your company, what you had to do is to commit yourself through contracts to arrangements which made your various constituencies better off than they otherwise would have been. So you can't sell crappy products to people and charge outrageous prices. You can't pay terribly low wages and hope to get high levels of performance, right? With your customers, and the whole thing, and the employees, your customers, your shareholders, and your community, you have to sort of go out and have picnics and everything of the sort. And the basic model is a success. That is, once you understand that your fiduciary duties run to your shareholders, but you can only discharge them to the extent that you manage to win over other people through the marketplace, everything's fine. What the Business Roundtable wanted to do was to have it both ways. They wanted to say that free market economies obviously produce more and better goods than any other kind of economy that we have. But we have to recognize that the Milton Friedman, a tisk-tisk model of corporate supremacy, the only duty that the shareholders, that the corporation has, is to maximize long-term profits for the shareholder, is hopelessly passe. We have to think of this in larger contextual types of framing. So that sets the thing up. Now, what does Elizabeth Warren do? In a rather haughty letter that she directs to Jamie Dimon, she says, well, you know, we agree about a lot of this stuff. And then she gives her usual thoroughly misconceived notions of what it is that corporations do that are so terrible. And she says, since you believe in commitment to stakeholders, I want you to support my Accountable Capitalism Act, which, amongst other things, requires everybody to get a federal charter if they have more than $1 billion in sales. And on the other hand, also requires them to give 40% of their seats to workers or other stakeholders, we're not exactly sure who, and essentially to transform the American business. And that is a pretty insistent demand. She has no doubt about the wisdom of the proposal. I have never seen anything dumber in my life if you're trying to figure out how it is that you're going to try and improve the American economy. I'll just mention one thing. I believe there's only one commitment that a company executives ought to take, which is not to seek tariffs and subsidies in international trade markets. And my good late friend Roger Kerr of the New Zealand Business Roundtable actually got 60-odd executives to take the no tariff, no subsidy pledge. And it was responsible in large measure for taking an economy which in 1986 was dead in the water and turning it into one of the freest economy that we've had some 30-odd years later.
There was a lot of criticism of Warren from the most recent presidential debate because she was accused of being slippery on a pretty straightforward question, which was whether middle class taxes would have to go up to pay for her Medicare for All plan. So she never answered the question directly. It was put to her several times, but she kept repeating two points, which was that the wealthy and corporations would have to pay more and that for normal Americans, their costs, meaning their health care costs, would go down. Now, we should note Bernie Sanders, who's also proposing a Medicare for All bill, did concede in this debate that taxes would go up. So walk us through what the actual economic impact of a single-payer system like Warren is envisioning would be.
Okay, let's start with something first before we get there. One of the things that's going to happen is there aren't going to be as many rich people or as rich corporations if you put her plan into effect. Trying to go public with a private corporation and being subject to that kind of barrage will lead many people to temper their bets. So she's going to have less to work with. Then when you're trying to do Medicare for All, there's always the question of how it is that you manage to price all these services and to whom you have to give them. And the current system is always understood that unless you have some degree of payment responsibility with respect to people, the amount that they will demand will go up exponentially because essentially the only thing they will take into account is not the cost of the service, but the inconvenience and wait that they have in the doctor's office. So every single estimate of these programs projects that you're going to have to give lower salaries to physicians and other service providers, which means the supply will drop down, that you have to have enormous sums of money to cover all these obligations, which you cannot raise by quote-unquote taxing the rich. And so the way in which this thing will be solved is that you're going to have queues that will make the ones that you see in places like Canada look like short romps in the park. There's just no way that you can make supply and demand equilibrate under this. Then, of course, the question is, well, which services do you give? Right now, under Medicare and under every private health care plan that you could imagine, there is just an incredibly complicated set of judgments you have to make about which services are going to be covered and which ones are not. Is this particular surgery cosmetic, at which point it's out, or is this essentially designed in order to correct for some kind of facial defect, at which particular point it would count in its reconstructive surgery? Well, you have to make these determinations across a huge number of cases, and there's no market mechanism to help you, so the administrative costs of running this thing are going to go up. Then there is always the question, you don't have to just simply fund current services. There's the long-term question about capital improvements. One of the things that is always true about government programs is they become incredibly presentist. That is, can we balance the accounts today? And if so, we don't really worry about the deferred depreciation that's going to come to haunt us tomorrow. So if you want to take just a very modest set of plans, both in New Zealand and New Jersey, they had various kinds of no-fault plans for automobile insurance or other kinds of injuries. And in both cases, it wasn't the fact that the rules did or did not create optimal incentives for safe driving or careful products or safe products. What it tended to do is you basically funded these programs so you could meet your current expenditures, but future expenditures related to past injuries would only be covered by future taxes. So both these systems went belly up in very, very serious ways after they've been in operation for a number of years. That's exactly what's going to happen. They are going to do a form of accounting in which you don't book capital items for new equipment. You don't take into account depreciation of old equipment, offices, machines, and so forth. So you're going to kind of reduce the level of innovation to a third world state. It is very well understood that in places that try to do this, even like Britain, that modern equipment is very, very hard to come by, which means that the queues are extremely long. And the joke that was said in Canada is if you want to get an MRI for your dog, that's a market system you could get in tomorrow. But if you want to get it under the public health care system, you may have to wait 6 months because there's a queue, because there's insufficient supply of what's going on. This woman has no idea. I mean, the level of ignorance that she brings to these projects is stupendous beyond all belief about how it is that when you decide to give free care, everything else is going to change. The one characteristic that marks Elizabeth Warren as a primitive thinker on these issues is she thinks of everything as solely a matter of redistribution of wealth. Everything will be fine on the production side and the consumption side. Just the bad people, i.e. the rich and the corporations, will be poorer and everybody else will be richer, but everything else will remain exactly the same. But the moment you put these forces into action, everybody's going to respond to incentives, and the behaviors that you will see are extremely difficult to chart. But the only thing you're trying to figure out is which way will the pathologies manifest themselves. There's no happy ending in the kind of story that she wants to paint. And it's a pity that somebody could be so confident and so ignorant about all the things that she's supposed to know about. It's really a staggering achievement of intellectual arrogance and plain ordinary dumbness.
Well, I'm going to keep going at the risk of raising your blood pressure too high.
Oh, no, my blood pressure is fine. This is an easy call intellectually.
Well, let's talk about trade, because Warren, she has a different agenda than Donald Trump, but certainly not what we would call a free trade agenda. So there are a lot of elements to her trade proposals that we could talk about, but there's two in particular that I want you to get get you to weigh in on, and we'll do these one at a time. The first one, she says, if you read her trade plan, one of her big critiques of the status quo is she says that the current process is undemocratic and all the negotiations are held behind closed doors. She says you've got to make the negotiating drafts public so that the American people can know what's going on, so that they can be more involved in the process. And this does, Richard, it kind of plays on this innate sense that Americans often have that anything the government does out of the public eye is inherently suspect. And you just got to disinfect it with sunlight. So what could be wrong with that? Just a little transparency in the trade process.
Well, I mean, it's a much more difficult question. What you do is you have other governments and they have preferences about the way this thing works. The negotiations are incredibly intricate and very complicated. They come out in particular pieces. And if you disclose them from the American side, you've thereby committed to disclosing them for every other country in the world, some of whom think that these negotiations better go on in private. Also, if you start exposing them to the public will have some modest interest in what's going on. The real people who will be absorbed with this are the various interest groups who think that they've got a good deal in the tariff wars that they want to keep or a bad deal that they have to shift. So making the disclosure will increase the level of lobbying beyond all possible recognition. Then when you try to get the approval, what you will see is the president will get a package. The current system says you either take it up or down, but that's not going to happen the moment you get full disclosure. And everybody at the last moment is going to want to say, well, we have to basically undo this provision or add that provision in. The moment you do that within the domestic situation, you essentially make it impossible for other nations to deal with you. So we've always had the procedure, negotiate in secret, give the final program, and give it an up or down vote. And it's the only way that you will ever get, given the complexities that every other nation has in this system, any other kind of success. So I'm not against disclosure in ordinary cases, but think about it in the following way. Suppose you have two Senate committees or a House committee, and they're trying to negotiate on some kind of general plan, say for environmental controls of one form or another. Does anybody actually take the various drafts and expose them one after another to the public in real time? No, because you know that if you start to make that kind of disclosure, positions will harden very early on, interest groups will come at you, and nothing will ever get done. So all business negotiations have to take place to some extent under a veil of confidentiality. And what you're responsible for is not the individual moves and jukes and compromises along the way, but the final product. And you could evaluate the final product by reading it. You don't have to know the negotiating history to make a judgment. So what this is essentially is a recipe to exclude the United States from all international trade agreements. And by the way, she says she's not Donald Trump. But of course, if you read some of these things she's saying, she is a protectionist. It's to create and defend good American jobs. Who does that sound like? Donald Trump? Barack Obama? Raise wages and farm income. You may be able to do that, but if the object is we won't enter a deal with you as a foreign country unless you give us all of these advantages, what country is going to want to do business with you if you're supposed to get the lion's share of the gain and they're supposed to be left with the pieces? Combat climate change. How this is going to work on that, nobody understands it. Lower drug prices? Well, it's complicated. You lower the drug prices and you reduce the levels of innovation. Raise standards of living worldwide. Well, if you're doing it everybody else throughout the world and shrinking the pie by protectionist legislation, the people are really going to hurt the people everywhere else. And so then she says, look, I mean, the next sentence is a contradiction of the last one. We will engage in international trade, but on our terms. That's real bossy. And only when it benefits American families. How is that going to allow you to raise living standards worldwide? So what she is essentially an old line protectionist in somewhat new garb. It's a suicidal position. I opposed it when I saw it in the usual gentle patois of Barack Obama, who always said the wrong thing with the right words. He was a very good speaker and a very bad thinker on these things. Donald Trump is both a bad speaker and a bad thinker. And Elizabeth Warren, again, is clueless on this as she is everywhere else in terms of what she does. And so people who know something about the world realize what my friend Bob Ellickson calls the law of conquest. The more you know about a subject, the fewer degrees of freedom you have to change it in any kind of fundamental way. There are so many other constraints that you're not aware of as an outsider that you think you can turn the whole thing around. But you can't. And so what you really have to do is not to blow up everything where the world comes apart. You have to understand how to make incremental changes. But for that, you have to know the lay of the land at a level of particularity that she doesn't care to do. So she talks at this very, very high level of generality, knowing nothing about the consequences of her program. And she thinks that somehow or other, by sheer force of will, this one woman can transform the world. And I mean, I don't think that she will be elected. I think of her as a genuinely terrifying person as a potential president because of this combination of overconfidence on the one hand and abject ignorance on the other.
You mentioned in there the linkage between her views on trade and her views on climate. I want to stay with that for a minute because this is a part of her proposal that's probably not that well understood by the public. So she's, as one would expect, she's a big advocate of green energy and public subsidies to that end, and also using public power to reduce carbon emissions. And she worries that cracking down on carbon emissions here just leads firms to take their carbon production overseas and export those products to us. So she proposes something in this document called a border carbon adjustment, in which we would essentially impose tariffs on people exporting to the U.S. to bring their costs to parity with the American firms that are operating under restrictions on their carbon emissions. So in a sense, she's sort of taking seriously the conservative critique that those kinds of policies will just move businesses overseas. But her reaction is to say, in essence, they want access to our markets. They're going to play by our rules. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, this proposal has been put forward by many, many people. The efforts to try to figure out the amount of carbon dioxide or carbon fossil fuels that are put into any particular product is an absolute nightmare. All you have to do is to ask yourself about the length and the complexity of the supply chain and your ability to fabricate lies one way or another about what inputs take place at one place. And you will realize if you're trying to do this with hundreds of thousands of goods crossing the border in different categories and every day, it just administratively overwhelms you. It cannot be done. And if you do really impose it, it's not that you're going to have play on somebody else's terms. People are going to charge higher prices for sending goods into America, and it means that consumer preferences are not going to be satisfied because the tax that you impose on foreign supplies is going to be passed forward to American consumers or producers. This then becomes a complete disaster. If you start to impose these things on intermediate goods that are used for American firms to create exports outside the United States again. And so what you do is you're going to create this carbon tax, raise the prices. Then when you try to sell your goods elsewhere, you're going to be met with an objection because what will happen is supply chains will migrate outside the United States to countries which don't have that thing. And so if you're trying to sell goods, say, in Europe, instead of coming to the United States where you have this carbon tax, people are going to go to Brazil or to Canada or somewhere else where it doesn't happen, and then sell in the European market that we're trying to sell into. So every time you try to go through the United States to get imports for exports, this thing is going to be ruinous. The other problem is, why do you want this thing to begin with? There is a huge amount of belief in the United States today on the part of many people that, you know, the climate change wars are near upon us. If you actually look at the numbers, none of this seems to make any sense. I don't want to go into all of the numbers here, but very instructively, there was a letter that was written by 500 scientists to the head of the United Nations saying, in line number one, there is no carbon or climate emergency. And no matter where you look, the evidence is actually pretty good. So my favorite statistic is between February of 2016 and February of 2018, the temperatures dropped 0.57 degrees centigrade. If you believe that the only driver of temperature change is carbon dioxide, and that the more you have of it, the higher the temperatures are going to go, you don't have an explanation as to why temperatures should decline in this particular level. And you certainly don't have an explanation of why over it is that the last 20 years or so that global temperatures have essentially remained constant, that the amount of greenery on the Earth's surface is up by 13%, that the polar bears are doing fine, that the walruses are doing fine. All of the so-called catastrophes that are supposed to be taking place just aren't taking place. So the first thing you have to do on this debate is to step back and to start to think about it. And this gets me back to the dangers associated with Jamie Dimon and his, I think, very dubious scheme to talk about stakeholders and so forth. One of the things that these stakers shall do when they get their federal charges, courtesy of Miss Elizabeth Warren, is they're now going to have to take various kind of smart green steps to prevent global warming, which will cost a fortune and do nothing of any particular consequence. And so this woman essentially promises redistribution, Social Security increases benefits, Medicare for all, and so forth. Anybody who has those kinds of grandiose objectives is going to be like the Soviet Union. The Soviet Constitution is filled with rights to housing, rights to food, right to an education. It's got the right to housing, but no housing. It's got the right to food, but no food. It has the right to an education, but in most cases, no education. And what you really have to do is to understand that every one of these programs, which purports to transfer wealth to the poor, is just going to simply impoverish a nation. And if you impoverish a nation at the level that her programs will do, there will be no winners that will emerge out of this situation. You cannot shrink an economy by 10 to 20% at the least and hope to find some large group of middle-class workers who are going to come out the better. So this woman leaves an intellectual pipe dream. It is just amazing to me how utterly oblivious she is to objections. You read, Troy, any one of the statements that she puts out, and you ask the following question: well, the objection has been raised and I meet it as such. Have you ever seen any – I'm going to ask you a question. Have you ever seen any of those words in any of the documents you've seen from her?
No. No. As a matter of rhetoric, this campaign has been defined by her evading almost all of the critiques that have been presented to her in public.
Yeah, I mean, and public, and it's in the writing. Everything she says are wrong. I mean, for example, when she talks about corporations, she makes such stupid statements as no corporation ever educates its employees. How do you make money if you have an untrained workforce? She never answers. She treats dividends and buybacks as though they're robbing workers. What they're doing is they're giving money to new and more nimble firms so they can actually increase job production. It's a positive, not a negative. But that letter that she wrote to Jamie Dimon possessed so much ignorance, so much downright foolishness in every particular sentence. And she cites these semi-popular sources, which are absolutely worthless on this stuff. It's all the patina of being a Harvard professor. But the only thing you do if you were running Harvard Law School today and she wanted to come back is not hire her. To be as simple as possible. This is just absolutely disqualifying as any kind of serious work.
All right. Unambiguous, I think. Thank you,
Richard. It certainly is.
Thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column. It's called The Libertarian, and you can find it at definingideas@hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.